Who am I to tell you how to do sprint workouts when I seem to have some trouble doing them properly myself?
Welcome to the Be Rad Podcast, where we explore ways to pursue peak performance with passion throughout life without taking ourselves too seriously. I'm Brad Kearns, New York Times bestselling author, former number 3 world-ranked professional triathlete, and Guinness World Record Masters athlete. I connect with experts in diet, fitness, and personal growth, and deliver short breather shows where you get simple, actionable tips to improve your life right away. Let's explore beyond the hype, hacks, shortcuts, and sciencey talk to laugh, have fun, and appreciate the journey. It's time to be rad. Hey man, how's your sexual function? Oh, uncomfortable talking about it? Look, we talk about our injured knees, our belly fat, so it's time to get focused on function. I want to tell you about GainsWave. This is a cutting-edge protocol where a handheld device sends low-intensity shock waves into your penile blood vessels to stimulate a healing response and promote increased blood circulation and the growth of new blood vessels. A skilled practitioner puts the GainsWave magic wand onto your magic wand, and after a series of 6 to 12 very brief treatments, which are painless but extremely effective, you get real results. GainsWave reports an 80% success rate. Now, we know that popping pills is a popular penile protocol, but when you're working with clogged pipes, you just get a temporary band-aid effect when you take prescription drugs. GainsWave addresses the cause of age-related decline by stimulating growth factors and activating dormant stem cells. Translation: stronger, harder, more sustainable erections. I learned about GainsWave from my podcast guest, Dr. Judson Brandeis at the Brandeis MD Clinic in Northern California, and there's a robust network of GainsWave providers that you can find on their website near you. Complete a series of treatments, and the beneficial effects will last for a long time, especially if you eat and exercise well to promote overall vascular health. It's a tune-up for your equipment, and while it's great for ED, GainsWave is for any man that wants to combat the effects of aging and get a little boost for your A-game. So please visit GainsWave.com/Brad. That's GainsWave.com/BRAD to find a practitioner in your area, and you can take advantage of my special promotion. Buy 6 treatments and get one free. You have nothing to lose and lots to gain from GainsWave.com/Brad.
Welcome, listeners, to another Q&A episode. Thank you so much for writing in so many thoughtful questions and lengthy commentaries. A lot of them are success stories, compliments, or feedback for the show. So we are going to dig into the mailbag, and I can't wait to engage and race through the many pages backed up of people writing in at podcast@bradventures.com. We read everything. We evaluate everything. We're so happy to be on this journey with you. And I want to give a special thanks out to all the devoted listeners that have helped us bump into the top 50 rankings of the Apple Podcasts Fitness category, an extremely crowded category of great shows. And it's a great honor to be up there. And it helps with the visibility so much to be highly ranked, because then new podcast listeners can navigate on Apple Podcasts and find the show prominently displayed as one of the choices. It also helps tremendously if you can go and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, or if you listen through another podcast player like Spotify. It's a great, great service to the show, and it helps increase our attention and prominence. And if you take the trouble to do so, I appreciate it greatly, and we'll also do something back for you. So leave a review, send a screenshot, or just say, "Hey, Brad, I left a review. I'm too lazy to take a screenshot." We trust you, and we will get you a free BRAD nutrition product of your choice. Just email podcast@bradventures.com for details. Thank you so much for listening to this top 50 ranked show. And then we go to the questions. The first one is from longtime listener Jay Dominic. He says, "Brad, I've been following your dietary journey and evolution. I especially like the podcast with Jay Feldman, where he's talking about energy balance, philosophy. And Jay says, as you add carbs back into your breakfast, have you noticed any changes to your blood work, such as fasting insulin, HbA1c, ratio of triglycerides to HDL, and so forth? Great question, because a lot of the programming and the dogma that we've been hit with, especially in the ancestral health scene, is that carbs are somehow considered evil. And this is an insight that I think is extracted from the disease paradigm, where we have massive numbers of modern population consuming too many calories in general, too many processed nutrient deficient calories, and not doing sufficient exercise, and therefore heading down those well-trodden, disastrous paths to metabolic disease, cancer, heart disease, and all the major killers and causes of accelerated aging these days. So if you have good metabolic health and you're leading an active, energetic lifestyle, nutritious, easy-to-digest carbs are a very important aspect of how to get maximum energy, performance, and recovery. So one of the main changes in my blood work, Jay, that I've noticed since doing this little experiment to dramatically increase carbohydrate intake and total caloric intake that has now lasted for a year and a half or so. I started in May of 2022, inspired by Jay Feldman and many others who are singing the same tune about rejecting some of these notions that we have to devotedly restrict carbohydrates in order to perform or to get these metabolic and blood benefits. I've noticed that my blood work is still exceptional category. There's no risk factors to worry about. My fasting insulin is like 2.7, which is extremely low. The same with HbA1c, triglycerides to HDL. My HDL is higher than my triglycerides, so I'm better than the ideal 1-to-1 ratio. If you are in the category of carrying excess body fat, wishing you could remove it, having some concerns on your blood work, then you have a different set of decision-making parameters than someone who is active, energetic, and healthy with good blood work, obviously. But at the same time, I'm going to contend that any type of restrictive diet is going to deliver excellent results when you are in that metabolic disease risk category. It simply means get up and get moving more and quit eating so much food, especially processed foods. So you can try a phase of time-restricted eating. You can go on a ketogenic journey, as we describe in our best-selling book, Mark Sisson and I, The Keto Reset Diet. We have a six-week protocol where you can do a reset for your metabolism, fine-tune your fat burning, cut those carbs out for a devoted period of time, and kick over into fat burning and away from carbohydrate dependency. But mainly, before we get into the nitty-gritty details of dietary transformation, the simple first step to take is to just eliminate nutrient-deficient processed foods from your diet. And by doing so and emphasizing natural, nutritious foods, you are going to have tremendous health breakthroughs, perhaps without the risks associated with those restrictive diets that can easily become too stressful. And we have now talked about for quite some time the highly devoted, type A, goal-oriented peak performers who have engaged in restrictive dietary strategies such as keto, such as time-restricted feeding, and tried to continue crushing their workouts at 6 a.m. in the CrossFit gym or out on the roads and trails. And when you stack up all these stress factors on one side of the balance scale, you are easily trending into an overly stressful lifestyle pattern, which can cause compensatory responses. They call it the compensation theory of exercise, where if you don't eat enough and you exercise in an overly stressful pattern, you're going to turn down an assortment of very important metabolic, hormonal, and overall systemic functions, especially things like your thyroid get disturbed. People talk about adrenal fatigue, brain fog in the afternoon. All these are symptoms of overly stressful patterns that can include not just those workouts being too challenging, but also not fueling yourself sufficiently with nutritious carbohydrates, proteins, and fats. Okay, so just to get back to answering this question, the main change I noticed in my blood work was a good bump in serum testosterone levels up over 800 over the past 4 or 5 years, as I've tested incessantly my serum testosterone has ranged from 560 to 1,008. And that's a pretty big range, but it's all in the pretty healthy category where I'm generally in the 650, 750, 800 range. But I did notice a distinct bump when I started to go deliberately to that huge bowl of fruit in the morning, that huge protein smoothie following that up, instead of my historical pattern of fasting or consuming minimal calories until midday and then sitting down for a big meal. So my takeaway here is clean up your frickin' act and get rid of those processed foods by any means necessary, especially if you aspire to lead a healthy, active, energetic lifestyle. And then if you want to dabble in some form of restrictive eating because you simply can't stay away from indulgent foods, go ahead and knock yourself out. But I also contend when you emphasize natural, nutritious, easy to digest foods, you're going to self-regulate. You're going to optimize your appetite and satiety hormones such that you consume an appropriate amount of calories every day to fuel your active, energetic lifestyle. You don't have to look at apps or charts or starve yourself or struggle or suffer because it's not 2 o'clock yet, but you're dying to eat, but you're trying to do a time-restricted pattern this week, or you're gonna can't wait till your cheat day on the weekend where you can overindulge. All that stuff I consider to be nonsense when we're not focused on the central point of emphasizing natural, nutritious foods. And a quick example of that is if you're going and eating big bowls of fruit or having an omelet for breakfast or a wonderful steak dinner with the accoutrements that you love on the side, you're going to naturally feel satisfied, especially when you emphasize dietary protein, which is our number one most important objective to achieve in the diet. Protein is highly satiating to the point that you're not going to get yourself into trouble or pick up some extra pounds of unwanted body fat by consuming too many omelets or too much ground beef or too many steaks, in contrast to having these indulgent foods around and getting into the pint of ice cream to the extreme extent because you're trying to recover from that exhaustive 6 a.m. workout at the gym later that day. So that's my answer to Jay. And he continues on with some more comments. I myself have pushed the boundaries of fasting too far, and it can result in cold hands and feet and also increased cortisol, says Jay. And that's super interesting comment because I have also noticed on those days when I don't consume sufficient morning calories per my new pattern that I talk about so much, I get these experiences of feeling cold in the afternoon under normal conditions. And then I go and get myself a big meal and things correct. And I possibly am now, after a year and a half of turbocharging my metabolism with increased caloric intake, I am possibly more sensitive to the times where I don't get sufficient calories. In other words, my adaptability to go long periods of time without eating has diminished and I get hungry more easily, especially in the morning. I get intense sensations of hunger if I don't go to my typical protocol of the big bowl of fruit and the big protein smoothie, or if I'm making eggs or a proper meal, which also happens frequently in the morning. Interesting, isn't it? Because we've talked for so long, especially with the ketogenic boilerplate and the low-carb, the fasting communities saying, boy, I can work all morning and feel super productive and alert and energized, and I'm not even hungry anymore. And isn't that a fantastic bonus from doing all the hard work to become fat adapted? Now, indeed it is if you're referencing the disease paradigm where previously you couldn't do so much as skip a single meal without feeling famished and reaching for the nearest vending machine or getting brain fog and so forth. Those are signs of poor metabolic flexibility. So I'm not going to discount or unwind any of the stuff we've talked about, but I also echo Jay Feldman's wonderful position that he described on our podcast interviews where perhaps experiencing sensations of hunger is a good thing because you have turbocharged your metabolism and you are a more active, energetic being that is maybe not best served to wait around until 12 noon in the name of health like I did versus going and getting some nutritious food to fuel a busy day. And that side effect of turning down thermoregulatory with cold hands and cold feet is definitely a proof or a validation that your body will turn down the flames when you don't fuel it sufficiently. So now Jay says, my own breakfast has evolved from fasting or just eating fat and protein to where now I'm eating a 3-egg omelet, a piece of fruit, black coffee. I do like adding carbs back in, but I don't want those wild spikes and crashes in blood sugar that I used to have with the standard American diet. Very well said, because when we talk about carbs and people say I'm sensitive to carbs, what we're really talking about for the most part is that sensitivity to nasty, nutrient-deficient processed carbs, which we in standard American diet eat way too much of, and somehow they've been grouped together with natural, nutritious sources of carbohydrates, particularly fruit. So if anyone wants to write into the show or stop me on the street and say, hey, Brad, actually eating fruit can be unhealthy and you can overdo it and damage your liver with too much uric acid, I will shoot back in your face and say, look, you're talking about insights pulled from the disease paradigm of people who have poor metabolic health. And I challenge anyone to tell me that my beautiful bowl of fresh fruit every morning is unhealthy. Okay, this is still Jay talking on a different subject. He says, I heard a recent podcast from Saladino where he reviews his blood work, and Paul mentions that he too has improved some of his markers, especially free testosterone, by phlebotomy to lower his iron levels. Do you have any thoughts about this? What are your views on total testosterone versus free testosterone? Do you know athletes that pay attention to their ferritin level? That's about, what, 6 questions in one paragraph. Nice, man. That's why I like the sharp listeners. We don't got no fluffy questions on this show. So improving free testosterone through phlebotomy, I have never heard of that. I will certainly accept Saladino's explanation, as he's a well-trained physician and knows a lot about this. We are very familiar with the risks of higher iron levels associated with all kinds of disease risk and poor metabolic health. And I have been in that category myself a couple times in my past, where the recommendation was to go give some blood and get that iron back into healthy range. But I did not know there was any association with a testosterone level from having elevated iron. Now, views on total testosterone, often called serum testosterone, versus free testosterone. Most people offer the soundbite up that free testosterone is more important because free is the circulating amount in your bloodstream. But it's really highly nuanced. And I've done a lot of research here. I'm working on a book about testosterone. I've listened to Tommy Wood, one of the most respected physicians in the ancestral health scene. And he contends that serum testosterone is a very good indication of your overall hormonal health, as is free testosterone. But again, just obsessing with free testosterone at the expense of serum testosterone or diminishing that can be a mistake. Point that Tommy makes is that free testosterone is measured in pictograms, which is it a trillionth or a millionth of a gram or something? So we're talking about infinitesimal amounts in the bloodstream. There's some potential for variation in test results just because it's so small, or especially day by day, where it might be better to look at the total amount circulating. That would be the serum testosterone, and associate the free testosterone together with the healthy serum level. So most of the charts that you see are the ranges, the average values that you see on a blood test, or you can Google on the internet. They're talking about serum testosterone levels. Now, in certain conditions of poor metabolic or overall health or elevated stress, chronic stress levels, you can have a healthy serum testosterone level, but an unhealthy free testosterone level. And I, too, have been in that category before, where my free T was outside of the healthy range, even though my serum T was decent. So for overall hormonal health, we want to see a high serum testosterone level, not normal, but high. Because remember, we're talking about a population that is in epidemic decline of average testosterone levels by about 1% a year since the 80s. So indeed, grandson has lower testosterone than dad, who has lower testosterone than grandpa. And this is a disaster. It's blamed on many things, including the environmental pollution, the estrogenic influences in the environment, the chemicals from our skincare, home care, cleaning products, detergents, drinking and consuming food out of plastic containers, all kinds of things. The EMFs are being blamed for this too, as well as the global obesity epidemic and the epidemic of poor metabolic health and the increased incidence of visceral fat accumulation around the abdomen, which is a known testosterone killer. So we have all these things working against us today, to the extent that if you deliver a blood test and your doctor says, hey, well, your testosterone is normal, you do not want to settle for normal. You want to be exceptional by today's standards. And I'm reflecting on the time when I've done some postings about my blood tests and my testosterone levels over time on Instagram, and talked about them on the podcast too. And one time I was patting myself on the back for being in the 95th percentile for males in my age group. And then I'm like, wait a second, 95th percentile should be considered okay or average versus exceptional, because we're competing or comparing against a bunch of sorry ass, floppy spare tire people as the metabolic norm in today's world. So shoot for the skies here, man. Testosterone is the essential male hormone for energy, focus, peak performance, recovery, and it's a very, very good proxy for your overall state of general health and fitness. That's why I test it obsessively. It's very sensitive to changes in things like your overall stress levels. So if you have high cortisol, that is known to antagonize your testosterone levels. And that will get you away from chronic stress lifestyle patterns. In my case, as I mentioned, my range from 560 to 1008, I think most of that variation came from my training patterns, particularly when I was pushing things a little too hard and I would go in and deliver a lower number than the previous time. So get your testosterone optimized, both serum and free. Certainly don't obsess on free testosterone at the exclusion of serum testosterone. We want both of those numbers up high. And I thank my consultation with Merrick Health for suggesting some targeted supplementation that seemed to give me a significant bump in my free testosterone levels. And that was taking things like boron and vitamin B6. And you can check out a personal blood consultation service where an expert can give you some recommendations rather than me making a blanket recommendation. Try this supplement and you'll raise your free testosterone. Not that simple. Okay, so I think that covers the question from Jay. And now we go to, more stuff from Jay. Hey, that's what you get when you get a great contributor. Brad, can you do an episode on your daily diet but get more into macros? How much protein, fat, and carbs do you consume in grams at each meal? My answer right now, I can save you the trouble. I have no freaking clue. The last time I measured my macros was many years ago in the course of writing actually several books where we put in dietary measurements and sample meals. Like, what is an omelet? It's 43 grams of protein, 12 grams of carbohydrate, and 27 grams of fat. So we have all that stuff archived for eternity in the Library of Congress and elsewhere that you can look up and get some great stuff in there. I believe the Primal Blueprint 21-Day Total Body Transformation, as well as the Keto Reset Diet, had a lot of macro analysis in there. Personally, I think it's a waste of energy and time, and I don't want to over-obsess on things like that to the extent that it crowds out better things to do with my day, and ways that I can be more productive or enjoy my life more. So I can't imagine measuring my caloric intake. And we also have to recognize that when we're playing around on the internet or getting our fancy new app that's talking about calories, we are making a quite poor estimate of the true caloric contribution of the food you eat, and also a pretty poor estimate of the amount of calories that you're burning during a workout. So when you go to the gym and you squeeze the handles, or you're wearing a smartwatch and it said that you burned 437 calories during your hike or your workout, it's just really a wild guess based on some things that can range a lot. And also with the food, we have to remember factors like If you're consuming processed nutrient deficient food, it might have a caloric value, but if your body has a hard time burning it, such as the common criticism of refined industrial seed oils, it really doesn't do any good to count those calories as anything except for health destructive ingestion of toxic agents. It's also interesting to recognize that there's a so-called thermic effect of food, and depending on the macronutrient, a portion of the energy goes to digesting the food itself, protein being by far the highest. So it's believed that the thermic effect of ingesting protein is around 20%. So if you have five eggs, one of those, 20%, is the energy, the caloric energy is devoted to digesting the protein. Also, protein is very almost impossible to actually use to burn for caloric energy for output. So it goes to the building blocks of life and important essential biological functions in the body. So there's really no justification whatsoever to count protein calories in your daily caloric intake in the name of trying to reduce excess body fat by counting the calories that you burn and counting the calories that you eat. So from here for, if you have one takeaway from this commentary, is forget about protein calories, except for to emphasize them as your number one dietary goal to ensure that you get your daily biological functions met. Especially for those in the older age groups, it is known that the elderly have a much more difficult time with protein synthesis than younger folks. So, my son, who's 25, consumes a crap ton of protein, keeps calling for more bags of B-Rad Superfuel. I can't believe you finished five already in a number of months, but he is lifting weights. He's maintaining a frame with 215 pounds of solid muscle and chowing on the protein. But my mother, who's 86 and active and energetic and doing great, also has increased protein requirements. So they should be fighting in the cupboard over that bag of B-Rad Superfuel to make sure that they go over and above and get a very good dialing in of necessary protein intake. It's also believed that many seniors do not consume sufficient protein because they're not out there cranking up the blender and pouring these big smoothies like the kids that coming home from the gym are. So there's a lot of categories of people that need extra protein, and it's believed that a lot of people are falling short. And when you fall short on protein, you will get tired. You will not recover as well from stress and from workouts, and you will turn down essential metabolic functions to where you have those afternoon blues and brain fog and increased risk of injury and soreness and stiffness after workouts. So get your protein needs dialed and don't worry about counting calories. Also, as Jay Feldman talked about, when you consume junk like refined industrial seed oils, processed sugar, chemical-laden foods, they promote the release of endotoxins. That's an internally manufactured toxin, namely lipopolysaccharide, it's called. They promote the release of these chemical agents into your bloodstream such that you have a difficult time burning these nasty processed food calories for energy, and you slow down your metabolism. It also interferes and causes difficulty with burning stored body fat. That's why these seed oils are blamed as the number one culprit for insulin resistance and metabolic disease these days. They interfere with your ability to burn body fat. So if you can't burn stored body fat, you become reliant on ingested calories. And if you're ingesting crappy calories, you're going to go down that path to obesity, metabolic syndrome, type 2 diabetes. So again, clean up your diet. Oh, here's a fun question, the final one from Jay. Brad, if you were named Surgeon General of the United States of America, what would your recommendations be for the general public in terms of diet, exercise, sleep, sun exposure, breath work, etc.? Thank you for that question. Here's what I would do. First things first, I would make every government worker, because I would have some influence and control over millions of employees work for federal, right? I would make every government worker complete a mile before sitting down to work every single day. This is a new law and a mandate for all government workers. I was praying that Governor Arnold would do that in the state of California when he became governor. I talked and actually pursued this objective with my good friend, the former state superintendent of schools in California, Tom Torlakson, who's a lifelong runner and a good coach for decades of high school distance runners. And I said, can we possibly do this? Can we have it be a school law? Just like when you get up and have to salute the flag and say the Pledge of Allegiance, that was baked into law, right? When we were growing up, I think it still is, I'm not sure. Can we just make every kid run a mile in the morning? I didn't succeed on the institutional level, but with my charity that I used to run, it was a kids' fitness charity called Running School. Get it? Running School. Running School. We went into targeted elementary schools and put on these great fitness events several times a year to encourage the kids to enjoy cardiovascular exercise and get out there and get active and even compete and try to improve their times in the widely tested fitness gram, it's called, where they used to be called the presidential fitness test, where every kid in fifth grade in the state of California is tested at their time in the 1 mile run. And they had a disastrous failing rate back when the latest research was published. So like 40% of the school children in California could not complete a mile in the basic standard time to be considered fit. And this is a great predictor for lifelong disease patterns associated with being inactive and unfit. So we tried to do something about it with Running School. And at my kids' elementary school, I succeeded in starting the day with what we called the morning mile. And we had parent volunteers out there on this course that circled the entire school. And when that first bell rang, the principal and the teachers all bought in to give the kids an extra chunk of time. When the bell rang, rather than reporting to class, everyone dropped their backpack and went to the trail and completed a lap around school and then went into class. So we had a small little blip of light covering this big picture of an inactive population. And if I were Surgeon General, I would step up and call that press conference and say, if you work for the United States government, you need to get your butt in shape. And the first thing you're going to do every day is complete a mile. what would I do with on the diet side? Well, I'd try to get rid of the government influence and the flawed public policy and the lobbying and the subsidies for things like corn and soybean oil, and that would be kind of fun. I would put processed food advertising in the same category as cigarettes and tax the shit out of all that stuff, and that's the only way that we're going to get widespread cultural change is to properly identify these things as poisons and disease-causing agents that should never be ingested, have the Surgeon General warning on a bag of potato chips rather than just on a pack of cigarettes. Oh my gosh, that would be super fun, huh? Item number five, Still J. I enjoyed your recent episodes talking about Liver King's PED scandal. I just want to say, I think I speak for the audience when I say you are a real Liver King. You're in the top 1% of fitness for your age group, have visible abs, and you're honest with us about what you take. Thank you for creating all this great content and allowing to join us on this journey. Thanks a lot, Jay. I appreciate it. And yeah, on that subject, as I talked about back when the scandals broke and the big picture insights about what we owe the public when we're a public figure and communicating in broad forum, everything I've ever said on this show is completely honest and not embellished. So I'm going to go back through the 400 episodes and validate that I'm not here saying that I do something that I don't do to make me look better, because I think that's real trouble. And that's the least that I owe the audience. So when I talk about my running injuries, I'm ashamed and embarrassed to admit that I make these mistakes, possibly due to misplaced competitive intensity and perhaps even flawed training protocols. So who am I to tell you how to do sprint workouts when I seem to have some trouble doing them properly myself, because there goes my strained glute muscle again and I have to back off for a couple weeks. But I'm certainly honest about the shortcomings and the failures and the rethinking and recalibrating of my fixed and rigid beliefs so that they're never fixed and rigid and I'm always open-minded. So I'm going to pound my drum like I just did saying what I would do when I was Surgeon General, but it's really, really important to have an open mind, think critically, and test and refine and evaluate things for yourself rather than just doggedly adhere to a dogma because it's familiar to you and things that are unfamiliar or counter to your belief systems cause you to recoil. So I will have responsible, interesting conversations with someone who's in the vegan camp, which I am not at all supportive of. And I'll talk about how that's a high-risk diet. I will validate their arguments, especially on the morality side, where they want to be good to the planet. Therefore, they've chosen not to eat animals. I will point out that mainstream agriculture is also highly destructive to the planet and the greenhouse gas emissions and all those counterpoints. And we'll talk through things, but I'm certainly not going to dismiss someone who believes differently than me, especially when there's a lot to learn from people that are on the other side of, let's say, a debate issue. Okay. And now we go to Bryce. Next question.
I want to discuss the incredible benefits of red light therapy and how you can get started with Mito Red Light. Mito, like mitochondria, red light makes the premier light therapy devices in the world and at incredibly affordable prices. I stand in front of my Mito Pro 1500 unit every morning, carefully exposing my eyeballs, other important balls, and my entire body to special wavelengths of red and near-infrared light. When I tell people about my daily devotion to red light therapy, they typically ask, does this stuff really work? And the answer is yes, and there are thousands of studies supporting its effectiveness. Here's how. It's called photobiomodulation, where specific wavelengths of red and near-infrared light, red's visible, near-infrared is not visible, that's why it looks like only half of your panel's working, these wavelengths help mitochondria in cells throughout your body produce more energy and clear waste products more efficiently. Red light exposure helps mobilize nitric oxide trapped in the mitochondria and allows oxygen to return to the cell and increase ATP production. The benefits are proven again and again for skin health, muscle recovery, joint pain, and numerous inflammatory conditions. Red light therapy is also beneficial for circadian rhythm alignment, because we generally get far too little direct sunlight and too much indoor blue light from screens and light bulbs at the wrong times. You don't hear much about this benefit of red light therapy, but when I turn on those lights first thing in the morning, as soon as I wake up, I walk across the hall, I stand in front of the panels, and I feel instantly awake and energized. And believe me, there's a lot of days where Mr. Health Guy here wakes up feeling a little groggy and a little whiny, like I don't want to get up now and get into my morning exercise routine. But when I stand in front of the lights, in 1 minute, I swear I feel wide awake. I get all that grogginess out naturally. It's super powerful, super effective. Besides all the healing and the cellular benefits, I also love it for being a natural wake-up machine. You have to try red light therapy. I am certain that you will become a devoted user. And guess what? Mito Red Light offers a 60-day no-risk trial period and a special 5% discount for B-Rad podcast listeners. Just visit Mito Red Light, M-I-T-O, redlight.com, and use the code BRAD on any of their products. Go for it today and get started on your red light journey.
He's an active 35-year-old who likes to keep in shape. Intermittent fasting for individuals who are already metabolically healthy and have good body composition is really not needed. My opinion, it's ideally for people who are still carb-burning and have a lot of body fat to lose and have not trained their body to be fat burners. I used to religiously track and fast all the time, but I realized I was actually losing muscle mass, not able to get enough calories in on such a restricted eating window, and generally felt like I didn't need to since I'm fit and have achieved good body composition. Also, too much time-restricted eating spikes cortisol and can become very rigid and restrictive. I still go periods of time without eating. Of course, I no longer go purposely out of my way to time-restricted fast. I used it at one point as a tool in the toolkit, but too many people are getting overly consumed by fasting and eating windows. I also generally try to eat my main protein meal earlier in the day to allow more time to digest like a big steak, and try to do all my eating during daytime hours. And also, way too many people are fasting all the way through the day and eating a big meal late at night. I have started to eat more during the day and will stop eating from dinner till lunch. Okay, very well said. Thank you very much, Bryce, especially a active 35-year-old who's metabolically healthy. I agree with all your message, and especially important point you made was that when you are trying to fit your eating into a time-restricted window, you are going to bump up against a real challenge when it comes to eating and assimilating sufficient protein calories. So it's known from science, great shows on Peter Attia Drive podcast from Dr. Don Lehman, one of the world's leading protein experts, where he says, you know, we can't assimilate massive doses of protein at a single meal. Ben Greenfield talks about this a lot. I think the number bantered about was 40 grams or perhaps 60 grams is the most that we can truly assimilate at a single sitting. And we want to strive to get somewhere around 1 gram per pound of body weight. That's on the high side of the recommendations, which I am now sticking to and promoting. And it's also easy to remember. So we want you to get around 1 gram of protein per pound of body weight per day. And so now if you're getting up there into, for example, I weigh 165 grams, if I were to try and eat in a time-restricted window, knowing that I can only get around 40 to 50 grams of good assimilation per meal, I'm going to be hosed there because I only have this many hours to eat. That's going to be like eating 4 meals inside this 12 to 8 eating window or whatever I'm doing. Dr. Lehman made a great point that he recommends getting protein first thing in the morning is super important because otherwise, since you have been fasted during your overnight sleeping period, you are going to go into catabolic to get your caloric needs met in the morning. So first thing in the morning, protein to maintain metabolic or anabolic state and avoid catabolic state, I think is a really good point. And he also said you want to take some protein at the end of your eating day. I like how Bryce says he doesn't eat after dark. I'm not quite there. Sometimes you're going to see some popcorn or some chocolate leaking in after dark, but good overall strategy to finish your eating in sufficient time to allow your digestive system to rest and set you up for a good night's sleep. But as your last act, a scoop of super fuel would be a fantastic idea to set you up for a nice evening of repair and restoration and rebuilding, because that's when the main rebuilding occurs, is during your overnight sleeping window. So you definitely want to have the amino acids circulating in your bloodstream, not overburdening your digestive system with a huge smoothie right before bed, although my son does that a lot, and that's how he's able to keep on a lot of extra muscle mass, which is his goal. But if you can just take that final scoop of protein, making sure that you're topping off your daily requirements and not getting into that deficiency, which can be defined as catabolic state as opposed to anabolic or metabolic, that is a great tips overall. And again, if you're someone who's struggling with excess body fat, you don't have that, you're not giving yourself that full license to go and eat whatever you want all day long, you need to implement tools like time-restricted eating, intermittent fasting, carb restriction for a ketogenic period. All those things can be highly effective, but we would like to view those as tools rather than the necessity of adhering to a time-restricted eating window for the rest of your life in the name of health. And I do appreciate how many of the leaders are now backing up, unwinding some of this commentary about how calorie restriction is equated with longevity. And it's simply been unproven ever in studies with humans, because we can't very well starve humans in the name of science and say, hey, these people lived 10 years longer than these guys who ate a lot of food and these guys were starved. We do have some great data from something called the Minnesota Starvation Experiment, which occurred with conscientious objectors to the Vietnam War. So rather than serve in the military or go to jail, they were offered some alternative options. And one of them was to go to a ward at the University of Minnesota. So this would be, I believe, in the late 60s. And they spent several weeks in there with very precise calorie restriction / starvation in the name of science. And there's some great podcasts about this. Malcolm Gladwell has one where these guys talk about the lifelong implications and repercussions from performing such a brutal experiment. The results were not pretty. These guys pretty much wasted away. They became obsessed with food. They had all kinds of health and metabolic problems that occurred and were difficult to unwind. There's one family members are interviewed talking about how their dad always had food with them wherever he went for the rest of his life because his brain was so traumatized by the Minnesota starvation experiment. But a simple takeaway was that, you know, everything tanked, especially things like testosterone and other important blood values from consuming insufficient calories. So starving the human has not been proven to do anything but lead to disaster on the extreme side. Now, can you extend your lifespan and escape disease patterns if you tone down your overconsumption of calories and your under-exercising? Of course, that would be the essential goal to turn your health around. Dr. Lane Norton simplifies it with the term energy toxicity being the main problem with global metabolic health today. And energy toxicity is simply that you are storing more calories than you are burning. And the way to address that is to get out there and get moving and then minimize your intake, especially of nutrient-deficient processed calories, as I talked about before. So that goes for everybody. And you can go into a quick program to drop several pounds of excess body fat by any means necessary and by any gimmick that you want. But looking at big picture, we simply want to emphasize natural, nutritious foods, and we are going to be looking really good over time. Okay, another question. How can parents prioritize protein for their kids when eating at home? What about when eating out? What kind of fast food choices? And the same question for adults. How can we make smarter decisions when eating in restaurants? Well, I mean, when you prioritize protein, you can do pretty well in a restaurant by asking for, I always get my hamburgers with a lettuce wrap because I don't want to eat their nasty bread. I'm much bigger fan of going to the farmer's market on the weekend and buying a fresh loaf of bread, which lasts, I think, 2 or 3 days and then starts to be beyond prime time. But when you have that fresh baked, and I talk to the bakers and how they're using only the freshest natural ingredients, I'm now back on the bread train after avoiding bread entirely for over a decade in the name of getting away from the grain-based diet. Now, when you make good, sensible choices in fresh baked products, I tremendously enjoy adding sourdough bread to things like a hamburger or eggs or things that I can control at home. But when you're out dining, stay away from the processed crap and try to do the best you can with what they're offering on the menu. And I will have intricate conversations with the server to see if they can do things my way. Like, please, can you cook my omelet in butter rather than vegetable oil? And they'll say, let me check. I'll be back. I'll ask the kitchen. Okay, thank you. Please do check. If you're talking about P.F. Chang's, sorry, guys. The guy came back and he said, no, I'm sorry. I cannot cook your Brussels sprouts in butter. We only do it in oil. And I go, well, that's not a very satisfactory answer. I can't believe you're saying no to me. Are you sure? And boy, I took the matter up to corporate. I sent some lengthy, thoughtful emails, did not get a reply from P.F. Chang's corporate. So I pounded on that hammer. That's one thing you don't want to do to me. If I write a long, thoughtful email and you don't even reply when I go out of my way to help you as a corporate entity serve the population better and have a healthier menu, oh no, I am not going to give that one up. So I finally got some response there. And I believe the resolution was that they offered me a $25 gift certificate, but pretty much said that they weren't going to tackle that challenge of transitioning from vegetable oil over to a healthy cooking fat like butter. And I think my answer was like, so you want me to spend this $25 on some more nasty food that you refuse to modify? And anyway, that's our mid-roll commercial for P.F. Chang's. Don't go there because they don't care about your health. And I've been going there for a long time. Love a lot of their entrees. It's delicious food, but kind of a bad experience there. So I'm going to share that with you, just like I promised to share everything. Oh, here we go. This is a YouTube comment about a comment written on YouTube. That's not my favorite way to engage because I can't really reply like I can an email. Our team can't reply very well, but we certainly do appreciate you commenting on the YouTube videos that we publish. And so this is going to be my indirect reply to Joseph. So it's about the show that I did inspired by the training methods of the great Jakob Ingebrigtsen, whom I just saw in person up in Eugene, Oregon at the Diamond League Prefontaine Classic, where he doubled back-to-back days with sensational, some of the greatest distance performances of all time. He ran the second fastest mile in history in 3 minutes 43, and the next day came back and beat fresh athletes with the fourth or fifth fastest 3,000 meters in history. So this guy is at the very top of his game, one of the highest performing athletes in the world and the greatest middle distance runner in the world. Joseph says, what people don't take into account is that the threshold training stuff, this is the stuff that Jakob promotes, sort of a novel training method called double threshold workouts. Joseph says it's a gimmick. The real reason for Jakob's success is that his dad started him running at a young age. He had a 10-year head start to begin building mileage when most kids are playing soccer or football. If you haven't noticed, the best chess players, football players had parents who got them started at a much younger age than their peers. I'm going to interrupt there and say, that's a good point. An early start is helpful. Tiger Woods got started at 2 years old and was hitting great golf shots when he was 3 and 4 and 5, but it's not the end all, man. So there's also examples of athletes who have come to sport later and excelled. And this is some great commentary in my former podcast guest, David Epstein's book, The Sports Gene. My favorite chapter, it's called The Tale of Two High Jumpers. And he compares and contrasts two of the great jumpers in the world, a former Olympic gold medalist, Stefan Holm from Sweden, and the Bahamian Donald Thomas, who is still competing on the world circuit after 15 years, one of the longest careers on elite high jumping ever. And the quick story was that Stefan Holm was bred to be a high jumper since age 5, and he practiced every day for years and years, eventually won the Olympic gold medal. And this guy, Donald Thomas, was pulled off the basketball court at a junior college in Illinois. Some high jumpers dared him to try it because he was bragging at the brewery off campus that he could probably jump 7 feet, no problem. They said, oh, you don't understand. That's like near Olympic caliber. And they took him out to the track, and his very first attempt at high jump, the first time he learned the event or saw the event of what it was all about, he jumped somewhere around 7 feet. And they dragged him straight to the track coach's office and said, we just pulled this guy off the basketball court and he just cleared 7 feet in the high jump. And the coach is like, no way, not true. And less than 1 year later, after first being exposed to the high jump, this junior college basketball player from Illinois representing his nation of the Bahamas won the world championship in the high jump, clearing a height of 7'8", 2 meters, 30 or thereabouts. And so it was the compare contrast to say that those who are genetically gifted and of course have whatever athletic background he had as a baller was able to translate that immediately and quickly, a direct in your face dismissal of the widely touted 10,000 hour rule. It's just not true. It's not that simple, but hey, getting kids started in anything that they have a passion for and that can challenge them to be especially more active and athletic is great. So that will help me get back into Joseph's letter. Parents got them started at a much younger age. Also, Jakob was born into a family with Olympic medalist brothers to train with every day. They were doing great consistency since a young age. Now, if a high schooler who just started this and bought into Jakob's training protocol, they would never become good enough to get recruited by colleges. At least in the U.S., we have a long period of time. The high schoolers have 4 years to put up race times, and then in college, you can develop and develop. Then you, if you don't make the team, you're going to probably drop out of the sport. So we need long periods of development, I think, is his comment. And I appreciate you writing in. And it's probably a fair reflection to say that whatever specific protocol that Jakob is following, I wouldn't call it a gimmick. That's a little harsh. But it's just one element of his overall success formula. And one huge element indeed has been that he has been focused on these goals since age 11. And I will plug the fantastic YouTube series. It's a reality TV series filmed in Norway called Team Ingebrigtsen. And the documentarians spent a decade with the family. Again, Jakob has two older brothers that were both European gold medal champions and world champion or Olympic medalists in middle distance. So this running family was fascinating to follow for such a long period of time. And they have interviews with Jakob at age 11 saying, oh yes, my goal is to be faster than both of my brothers and to be the greatest runner in the world. And so here's this kid talking at 11, and now he's actualizing all those goals, and it makes the reality show that much more special. How's that, everybody? What do you think? Yeah, Jakob is something else. Look him up on YouTube, and you can see some of his racing. So Larry says, I've been subscribed for some time. After benefiting from the keto lifestyle, I find your videos very confusing as of late. I understand we're all different, but obviously you've never had a weight problem and you're an elite athlete. So thank you so much, Larry W., for the direct feedback. And I can understand how it might be confusing when I am a proponent of ancestral diet, the devoted elimination of nutrient-deficient processed foods, especially all manner of refined grains and sugars. And that means that you are, by definition, transitioning from standard American diet to what could be fairly called a, quote, low-carb diet. And now I'm here extolling the benefits of slamming a whole bunch of fruit every morning and making a devoted effort to go and find increased carb intake every single day. So again, I want to back up and distinguish between nutrient-deficient processed carbs, which will destroy your health, whoever you are, or are unnecessary, whoever you are. Even if you're a high-calorie-burning athlete with a six-pack who can slam down whatever you want, you know, more bowls of cereal at night and be no worse for the wear the next morning, it's still an athlete has high-performance needs and high nutritional needs. So I still don't see the justification for consuming nutrient-deficient processed carbohydrates, and it can be fairly called one of the biggest problems with the standard Western diet, along with refined industrial seed oils and all the processed foods that are made with ingredients like processed carbohydrates and seed oils. So I don't think there's any confusion there, and I don't think anyone can accuse me of dispensing confusing information on that point. But to Larry's other important point, I've never had a weight problem and I'm an elite athlete. So perhaps that puts me in different parameters. And indeed, I've said that myself. I've said it several times, even on this show. So if you're carrying excess body fat, I will help you with a lot of programming and content to first clean up your diet and go point toward nutritious foods. Get the junk out of your cupboard, get it out of your refrigerator. Go to the farmer's market, buy some eggs, buy some fruit, buy your favorite vegetables, buy some grass-fed beef, buy some pasture-raised eggs, go and get the oily cold water fish, and stock your environment with nutritious foods. And then we will check in a year from now and see if you've turned the corner from the accumulation of spare tire or getting rid of some of that excess body fat. I guarantee you're going to succeed simply by turning over to nutrient-dense, easy-to-digest foods. That's why I published my Carnivore Scores food rankings chart that you can download for free at bradkearns.com. And it's a tiered ranking system of the most nutritious foods on earth, both in the animal categories and the plant foods category. And I really am convinced after so long spending, obsessing and immersing into this world for 15 years and writing so many books about the topic and studying so many other great leaders and great researchers, that it really is the main gateway is to just clean up your diet, and then you're going to have tremendous success. And then if you want to write a year from now and say, hey, Brad, I only consume the most nutritious and well-chosen foods, and I'm still carrying 10 pounds of excess body fat. I guess I eat too much fruit, consume too many eggs, have too many servings of ground beef, or drink too many quarts of raw milk from the dairy that I drive out to and buy things fresh every week. What can I do? And then we can have some further discussion about refining and optimizing. But I still have yet to meet someone who is eating so cleanly and still struggling with excess body fat and adverse blood values, except for people who are still in recovery from long traumatic metabolic experiences, such as decades of working too hard, sleeping too little, eating shit food, and thinking they're going to turn it around with a six-month spa protocol of cleaning everything up. Sometimes you have to be more patient. sometimes the approach to exercise is overly stressful. So you kind of go in a circle and come back to square run, where you're burning so many calories in exercise and so exhausted and depleted that these nutrient deficient processed quick energy foods find their way back into your diet because you're over exercising. So everything has to be dialed and optimized. And I guess I'm referencing all the content that I try to put out there on this show, because we have sleep experts, we have fitness experts, we have everyday movement experts, and we have diet experts, and all the messaging needs to be rolled together to get things to happen and to get away from these disease patterns that are so common today. Gary Green made a quick comment on YouTube, and he said, how about a discussion about heavy metals contained in dark chocolate? And there's some controversy here, because a lot of people are talking about the bad test results on even some quality dark chocolate bars have been implicated to be containing elevated levels of dangerous heavy metals, things that we shouldn't be ingesting, like lead. And I asked my former podcast guest and artisan chocolate maker, Sean Askenozzi, about this. And he said that these contentions have been exaggerated. And if you have a test result that says the levels of lead found were 12 times higher than the allowable, he pointed me to an internet article where we're talking about such low amounts that it's kind of a misinterpretation of the results. There's no health risks involved. And when you source good bean-to-bar chocolate, which is the essence of all the commentary I have about dark chocolate, I even have an ebook called A Connoisseur's Guide to Dark Chocolate that you can download for free when you go to bradkearns.com, that talks about this a bit. But the heavy metal risks have been exaggerated for headline alluring, and it's generally nothing to worry about when you source good quality chocolate from bean-to-bar providers. And that distinguishes from the commodity chocolate that you see the major brands putting out, where the actual raw material comes from unknown origin, poor quality control standards, and especially from countries in Africa that are poorly regulated, that are very likely using child slave labor to bring you that inexpensive Hershey bar, Nestle's Crunch, Snickers, Milky Way, all the main stuff. So that's why I'm a big fan of the bean-to-bar chocolate movement and the fair trade stamp that you see on many bars, or when you contact the manufacturer, they assure you that they are a bean-to-bar provider, which means they know where they got their beans. They sourced them from farmers working with sustainable methods, not using child slave labor. And you're basically, just like many, many other products, you're scrutinizing the source, just like when you go and get grass-fed beef from the local farmer 30 miles away, and he's selling his wares in the farmer's market, as opposed to getting the mainstream animal foods that are produced by concentrated animal feeding operations and all the health objections and environmental objections those have. Last question for this show from Blue Dog on YouTube. Hey, Brad, I totally busted out laughing when you said, "We officially invite you to F off. I'm going to give that supplement a go. I'm not one of those people who sits around taking supplements and expecting wondrous things to happen." I think that was some of my commentary. I'm trying to keep some perspective on some of the claims that you see made about supplements and how amazing they are, and how now your workouts are 15% better than they were last week. Having been immersed in that world as a professional athlete on the triathlon circuit for many years, and being approached by so many people with their products claiming that they can improve my performance by 5%. And I'm like, wait a second. So you're telling me if I take this, the stuff in this bottle, I'm going to beat all these other competitors who are racing very hard and are the top guys in the world. I'm going to now beat them by a minute. You're full of crap. Don't even talk to me about that. Let's get reasonable and realize that the main goal of supplements overall is to supplement a healthy natural foods diet. So there's no performance breakthroughs that are going to be found with supplementation, it's only really going to be limiting the damage and destruction that's caused by strenuous and stressful workouts. So even when I talk about the whey protein and the creatine in the super fuel, we're talking about a convenient way to get your protein needs met. And same with the creatine, a convenient way to get the doses of creatine that your muscles need to optimize. And it can make you perform better, recover faster, be stronger, but only when you do the work necessary to maximize the benefit of the supplement and realize that it's very difficult to, with eating natural whole foods alone, it's difficult to get enough creatine every day. And it's difficult to get enough protein every day. But if you were able to, like my boy Andrew at Power Project, who eats 10 eggs every morning, he is probably not a great candidate to go and supplement with more protein or more of the great B vitamins or choline that are in the egg yolks because he's consuming so many eggs every single day. So I want to put that term supplement in the forefront of your mind and realize the literal meaning of it rather than looking for shortcuts and buying into all the marketing hype and the glitz and the messaging that is used to sell products thinking that you're going to get some amazing breakthroughs. So thanks for that comment, Blue Dog. And thank you all for listening, watching. If you want to join the conversation, send an email to podcast@bradventures.com. And I will see you next time for more Q&A. There's more, always more.
I want to discuss the incredible benefits of red light therapy and how you can get started with Mito Red Light. Mito, like mitochondria, red light makes the premier light therapy devices in the world and at incredibly affordable prices. I stand in front of my Mito Pro 1500 unit every morning, carefully exposing my eyeballs, other important balls, and my entire body to special wavelengths of red and near infrared light. When I tell people about my daily devotion to red light therapy, they typically ask, does this stuff really work? And the answer is yes, and there are thousands of studies supporting its effectiveness. Here's how. It's called photobiomodulation, where specific wavelengths of red and near-infrared light, red's visible, near-infrared is not visible, that's why it looks like only half of your panel's working, these wavelengths help mitochondria in cells throughout your body produce more energy and clear waste products more efficiently. Red light exposure helps mobilize nitric oxide trapped in the mitochondria and allows oxygen to return to the cell and increase ATP production. The benefits are proven again and again for skin health, muscle recovery, joint pain, and numerous inflammatory conditions. Red light therapy is also beneficial for circadian rhythm alignment because we generally get far too little direct sunlight and too much indoor blue light from screens and light bulbs at the wrong times. You don't hear much about this benefit of red light therapy, but when I turn on those lights, first thing in the morning, as soon as I wake up, I walk across the hall, I stand in front of the panels, and I feel instantly awake and energized. And believe me, there's a lot of days where Mr. Health Guy here wakes up feeling a little groggy and a little whiny, like I don't want to get up now and get into my morning exercise routine. But when I stand in front of the lights, in 1 minute, I swear I feel wide awake. I get all that grogginess out naturally. It's super powerful, super effective. Besides all the healing and the cellular benefits, I also love it for being a natural wake-up machine. You have to try red light therapy. I am certain that you will become a devoted user. And guess what? Mito Red Light offers a 60-day no-risk trial period and a special 5% discount for B-Rad podcast listeners. Just visit Mito Red Light, M-I-T-O, redlight.com, and use the code BRAD on any of their products. Go for it today and get started on your red light journey. Thank you so much for listening to the B-Rad podcast. We appreciate all feedback and suggestions. Email podcast@bradventures.com and visit bradkearns.com to download 5 free ebooks and learn some great long cuts to a longer life, how to optimize testosterone naturally, become a dark chocolate connoisseur, and transition to a barefoot and minimalist shoe lifestyle.